on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, KPP Financial President, Financial Advisor Steve Peasley.
You're listening to an encore presentation of InvestTalk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next InvestTalk.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Thursday edition of InvestTalk. No matter where you are, your investing journey, where we hope you feel comfortable being with us this hour. I want to hear what your life is like. Maybe where are you right now in your investment career? Do you have enough money set aside? Are you putting enough money away? We manage investments for our clients all over the place, all over the United States, but we also are often asked to help with other financial issues, insurance, estate planning, real estate. That's kind of what we do. The same is true for InvestTalk. Let's hear your questions about the money issues that are part of your everyday life. I would love to hear it. The actions that the central bank can take. You know, they could raise rates. Well, what rates do they really raise? What can they really do? Remember, the Federal Reserve Act includes two goals. So this is what the Federal Reserve goals are. They only have two. Promote maximum sustainable output and employment. In other words, economic growth and employment. And stabilize prices. In other words, fight inflation and fight deflation. Stabilize the prices. So the central bank can control money supply. That's all they can do. Their actions can be expansionary on the money supply and increase the money supply, or can decrease or contract the money supply. Now, also, of course, obviously, if they're going to stabilize prices, they're very focused on inflation, and we have absolutely no inflation. So they don't need to worry about controlling that part at all. But they don't have any direct influence on any of this. The growth of the economy, they don't have direct influence on that. Inflation, they don't have any direct influence on that. It's all indirect. And they can do three things indirectly. Open market corporations, the discount rate, by the way, that's the rate they can control. The one they talk about when they raise and lower rates is the discount rate, which means the rate they charge banks to borrow money from the Federal Reserve. So the banks can borrow money from the Federal Reserve and then lend it to us, and it's almost all profit to them, whatever interest rate they charge us. And then, of course, reserve requirements. That means how much money the banks are required to have at their bank, on their books. And if they can say, we want you to have more money on your books, that means they can lend out less. That means it will slow down the economy. See that they don't really control anything other than being expansionary or contractionary with the money supply. And they have different tools to try to do that. So that's how this works. I mean, you can get a lot more complex, obviously. But I don't want to. I don't think it helps you or me or anybody else. There have been studies showing that the Federal Reserve monetary policy does matter to the stock market as well. When the money is easy and supply is easy, the stock market tends to move up. When they start to contract, stock market tends to move down. Now, of course, all stocks don't necessarily move up and down, and there's different factors complicating factors come in. So it's not that simple. I'm just talking in a broad brush sort of way. Anyways, there's lots of studies. And, by the way, there's an informal article on investopedia.com about this, the Federal Reserve and what it does. Now, if you're interested, you can find it there. I thank you for connecting with us today. Do you have a question or comments about the Federal Reserve's action or inaction? Let's talk about it. You can get through right now at 888-99-CHART. You can call me anytime. So let's take this question that came in before today's program.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Justin. I'm a podcast listener from New York and have been learning from you both for the past several years, so thank you. I have a money manager question. Justin frequently discusses the need to take emotion out of investing decisions. The specific question is, Do you ignore market fluctuations against specific investments that you bought for the income-producing characteristics? So to give you examples, I own a REIT called HCP, a gold-producing fund with symbol GGM, and a triple-tax-free fund with the symbol MYN. I still believe all three are decent long-term investments, but they do show double-digit losses. Assuming I still feel they're all good investments, do I just ignore the market pricing of these securities or come to the conclusion I made a mistake? So I'm trying to figure out how professional money managers look at investments like that. Thanks very much. I'll listen to it on the podcast. Bye.
Okay, that's a very good question. You know, the wiggles and waggles of the market, do you pay attention? Especially if you bought something for the income stream. And the answer is, really, you don't pay too much attention to it because that's not why you bought it. If you bought it for income, and as long as that income is steady and going to continue, then you don't have to worry about it. Now, I won't say you never have to worry about it because you do have to keep an eye on, is that income going to be steady and continuing? Is there something that can disrupt it? And if that's something that disrupts it, does that mean I should take action? You know, so there, you can't just ignore it completely. Let's say you bought something and it goes out of business. Well, there goes your income stream, right? So you have to buy things that you're pretty confident about the income stream. And, you know, you could buy big blue chip stocks that have been around forever and increase their dividends forever, like Coca-Cola or somebody, you know, and not worry too much about it. But you could have said that about General Motors. They went out of business, filed for bankruptcy. See, so you can't just ignore the market, but the answer is generally, if you bought something for income and it's a very solid and you were comfortable with the ability to generate that income and they can pay that dividend to you or yield or whatever it is, then you kind of ignore it. You know, you don't pay attention to the corrections along the market. You might want to lighten up in a, you know, if you see a recession coming down the road, just so you can have some cash to buy that same income stream, same company at a lower price. That I have no problem with. That's the only time you probably should. Notice I said lighten up. I didn't say get rid of. Remember, you're looking for income, long-term income. And if you're looking for something else like growth, then the answer would be different. How much can we really expect from stocks, bonds, and cash over the next 10, 20, 30 years? Are we going to have to settle for smaller gains? That's going to be one of our main talking points today. Are you going to have to settle for smaller gains going forward than the most recent gains we've had in the past? So that's what we're going to discuss, one of the things we're going to discuss. I also want to talk about the junk bond market and oil. I read a very interesting piece about those situations I think we should talk about. And you know, you would think with the Federal Reserve meeting this week and the results of that meeting coming out today that nothing else happened economically during the week. No other data points came out. I think we need to talk about some of those other data points that came out, which I thought are very are important. I think they're very, very important. And I got an email this morning from someone, and it was Lee, and he wanted to talk about, or help me to talk about, Equity Key. Equity Key, you ever heard of that? It's not a reverse mortgage, but it's a way to get money from your property. And I pulled up their information and read through their documents, and I thought it would be something that maybe we could share. I think it's a pretty, you know, a pretty important, interesting thing that they're doing. It's not bad. I don't know if it's good, but it's not bad. But maybe we should go over what is Equity Key? What is it? And really, it's interesting. You're borrowing money against your house, but what are you giving up? But it's not a loan. And you're not signing your house over to somebody. It's still your house. So how's that work? It's called Equity Key. The hint is in the word equity. Those are things we're going to talk about today. I do have something I was reading that if we do have time, I'll get to it. But I also have not gotten to the last couple of days, so I need to do that. And that was bachelor's of science degrees that pay the most money getting out of college. And most of them are engineering degrees, by the way. So if you have kids or grandkids, tell them to get an engineering degree. Engineering, that's where the money is going to be.
Time for a market snapshot from InvestTalk for this Thursday, October 8th. The session today ended up higher after a sluggish start. The afternoon rebound accelerated after the release of the September FOMC minutes, which revealed that only one committee member believed that economic conditions do not warrant a rate hike, while other members believe that a rate hike will be appropriate before the end of 2015. Today's volume was below recent totals, as fewer than 900 million shares were traded. Today, the S&P 500 climbed 0.9%, while the NASDAQ Composite up 0.4%, underperforming throughout the day. For the year, the NASDAQ Composite up 1.6%, S&P 500 down 2.2%, Dow Jones Industrial Average down 4.3%, the yearly totals now, and the Russell 2000 down 3.4% for the year. This market update made possible by KPP Financial. Let's get back to this InvestTalk replay. You can still get your question to Steve and Justin, 888-99-CHART. You can call now. They'll answer your question on tomorrow's InvestTalk.
I'm registered investment advisor Steve Peasley. We're glad you're here for InvestTalk. Quiz time. When did the Fed come into existence? In the U.S., the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 gave the Federal Reserve responsibility to setting monetary policy. So it's not exactly a modern invention. If you have a question about the Fed or any issue closer to home, we're here for you at 888-99-CHART.
You're listening to an encore presentation of InvestTalk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next InvestTalk.
Judy in Thousand Oaks, how you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Thanks for calling.
I have a question about exchange-traded funds. Mm-hmm. Do they pay dividends?
Yes. If you buy exchange-traded funds that has dividends, yes, they'll pay dividends, yes.
Okay.
There are some exchange-traded funds, Judy, that specialize in dividends.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I haven't really got into exchange-traded funds.
I'm telling you, I think they're going to be, you know, it's a really good way, Judy, to instantly get diversified in a particular sector or a particular, or an index or a country. Very good way to instantly get yourself, and you can get out anytime. Like, you could trade it like a stock, and you can short ETFs if you want to.
Well, the one reason I was interested is because I don't really understand international, like some of the other companies that I'm in individually, so I mm-hmm. thought it would be better.
Actually, it would be, because you'll have a good diversification. Judy, thanks for the call.
Hey, you're welcome.
888-992-4278. Give me a call. I'd love to talk to you. What's on your mind? What do you want to discuss? How about, let's see, our main talking point today is about expecting smaller gains going forward. We've had, you know, the market over the last, I don't know, 100 years have given you about 10%. I think you're going to have to expect smaller gains going forward. I really do. Of that 10%, 3% is inflation. 3% was probably because of inflation. Inflation is much lower, so that's going to be less. And interest rates are very abnormally low. Abnormally low, and they looks like they're going to stay that way for some time. So that's not, you know, meaning your returns will probably be less. Oh, I heard you there. And the S&P 500 is trading about 17 times next year's earnings when the average is about 15 times. So there's a lot of signals telling us that at least you need to expect less gains going forward. Maybe 6 to 8%. And remember, it's all relative. Where are you going to go? You're going to go to CDs? You're going to get better returns there? No. Yeah. So where are you going to go? So, you know, the market is still the best place to be. You can see the latest dates for retirement reviews on InvestTalk.com. This is InvestTalk.
thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. How much can we really expect from stocks, bonds, and cash over the next 10, 20, or even 30 years? Are we going to have to settle for smaller gains? That's our talking point for Thursday's podcast. Bring your questions and join us then, please.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Job number one on Invest Talk is answering your questions. Our 24-hour listener line is open for any money questions you might have. The number is 888-99-CHART.
Hi. I have a basic question. All mutual funds got a different A, B, C shares. In which cases you can purchase A or B or C? For example, my financial advisor advised me to buy a C shares. I appreciate if you will answer this question. Thank you.
About mutual funds, they're talking about loaded mutual funds. Loaded means they charge commission. I don't like you to buy any loaded funds. I think you should buy all no-load funds where there is no commissions. A shares, B shares, C shares, H shares, I shares, those are all different ways they charge a commission. A shares charges up front. 5% is normal. Up front, they take, you give them $100,000, the broker takes $5,000, puts in his pocket, and invests $95,000. C shares takes 1% a year for 5 years. Now, which one's more expensive? The C share is more expensive. In a perfect world, or in most worlds. Why? Because they take, okay, they take 1% up front. Okay, well, then that means instead of $100,000, you put $99,000. And then next year, they're going to take another 1%. But what if you made 10% on the money? Now they're taking 1% of $104,000, 1% of more money. What if you double the money in 3 years? They've taken another 1%. The only time it works out is if you lose money. Then it's cheaper. But then again, you're losing money and you're paying the commission. Which one's better, upfront or on the back end? To me, the upfront's better. But I don't think you should pay a commission at all. But when you're dealing with a broker and that's how he gets paid, that's the only way he gets paid. Excuse me. Then you got to give the guy a break. He's got to make money somehow. My point is why don't you forget about that and maybe buy ETFs or just no load funds? I'm not a believer in buying loaded funds. I would never buy them. It's time for Invest Talk 101. Some ideas and tools to help you become a better investor. Let's take another look at our recommended book list. You know, we have a book list on our website. We're always asked about good books and other resources. And I always try to go look at our book list. We have a really good book list. There's a book there called High Probability Trading and takes the steps to become a successful trader. That's what the book is about. And a common denominator amongst most new traders that enter the market, they're gone after about 6 months. They lost all their money, they're gone. High probability trading softens that impact. It's still difficult. Don't think it's easy. It's difficult to be a trader. People think it's simple because the market's up or whatever, for whatever reason. Trust me, it is not. I don't consider myself a trader. I consider myself an investor. The investor is more long-term with a long-term approach as opposed to a trader who's looking for the quick return in a week, a day, a week, a month, 6 months, you know, just short term. Remember, the book is called High Probability Trading, Take the Steps to Become a Successful Trader by Marcel Link, L-I-N-K. You can see more about it right there on our book list. Look for the recommended books on investtalk.com. And that's Invest Talk 101. Got questions about trading? Why not ask? 888-99-CHART.
Choosing the right investment products, adjusting to life's surprise events. If it's about money and it's important to you, we want to know more about it. We're here for you. 888-99-CHART is how to reach Steve or Justin right now on Invest Talk.
Let's go to Chris in San Diego. How are you doing, Chris?
There's a lot of information around, and everybody has differing opinions on when to get into stock and when to get out of a stock, depending on it's moving up and moving down. But what do you do if it doesn't do anything for over a long period of time?
If a stock just sits there like a lump, in other words, dead money, the reasons that you bought the stock are still valid and in place, then you just stick with it. In other words, the reason you bought the stock, what was it? Well, it was growing its earnings. It was growing its business. It's got a great new widget that's coming out and it's selling like hotcakes. Whatever the reason was, and if it's a valid reason making money, and it has not changed, nothing's changed about that decision, then you stay with it. The problem, Chris, is stocks. I don't know if you've ever heard the statistics, but it's amazing that stocks, you know, like 70, 80% of the movement of stocks is like 3% of the time that you're in the stock. Like over a year period, most of the move comes in bunches. And if you're not in it that few days or few weeks that it moves, you've just wasted all your time and effort.
I see.
If the nothing has changed, in other words, no new competitor came out with a better widget to knock this one out, that's called creative destruction, by the way. No new something has destroyed what you bought the stock for. Then you stick with it. I know it's hard sometimes. There is a time when you give up, but that's not for years, not days or weeks or months.
So it's on the order of years.
Yes. If the reason that you bought it still is valid. Now, sometimes the reason that you bought it changes.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the question. Thank you. Everybody, this is Invest Talk. Thanks for investing this hour. You know, your time is very expensive. I know that. My time, everybody's time. Time is costly, and I do appreciate you investing that time with me. Now, we can't control risk, but we certainly can manage risk. Do you know how to do that? Do you know what risk is appropriate for you? Well, if you don't, we have a free risk analysis tool on investtalk.com. You can take the little 3-minute questionnaire and it'll give you a risk score from 0 to 99. And you'll find out how much risk you're comfortable with. By the way, the S&P 500 has a risk score of 80. 80. We'll be answering the phone next, and I'm ready for your question or comment at 888-99-CHART.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
It's one of the pillars of our retirement planning, Social Security benefits. But are you getting all the benefits you're entitled to? Let's talk to one of the authors of Get What's Yours, Secrets to Maximizing Your Social Security Benefits, Lawrence Kotlikoff, a Boston University economics professor. So we welcome Lawrence Kotlikoff to Invest Talk. Lawrence, give us a little overview of some of the most common scenarios faced by couples preparing for retirement.
Yeah, this is actually how the book got started, because Paul Solomon, one of my co-authors, is a tennis partner of mine, and we were playing tennis. And we took a break, and I asked him what he was going to do with Social Security. He and his wife were reaching full retirement age. He said they were both going to wait till 70 and take the retirement benefit at 70 at the maximum value. And if you take it at 70, it's 76% higher than if you take it at 62. It's about 32% higher than if you take it at full retirement age, which is now 66. So I said, well, that's good, but do you know about spousal benefits? He said, well, no, I can't get spousal benefits. I said, Paul, do you know about spousal benefits? He said, don't tell me. I know everything about it. I cannot get spousal benefits. This argument went on for about 5 minutes. Finally, I said, I'm going to make you $50,000 in the next 2 minutes, and you're going to buy me dinner. And that's what happened. I told him about how to get spousal benefits for free, which consists of one of the two spouses, in this case, his wife, who's slightly older. She did something called she filed for her retirement benefit. She asked for it, but then she immediately suspended it and allowed it to grow, and she started taking it then at 70. And for Paul, what he did is he went in and he filed just for his spousal benefit. So he got half of his wife's full retirement benefit, and he got that. It's about $12,000 a year for 4 years. He ended up with close to $50,000. That he knew nothing about. Had he not played tennis with me, he would have lost $50,000.
So you're saying that the person making the most money should file and suspend, and the person who made the least amount of money should file for spousal benefits?
If they're the same age, that would be true. But if, for example, Jan made less money, but she was a little bit older. So had Paul filed and suspended rather than Jan, she would have collected a higher benefit for fewer years. And so it worked out to be better that Paul got a lower benefit off of Jan for more years. So it very much depends on the specifics.
Right.
Social Security's experience. Yeah. And you can't try this before full retirement age, because if you do, then, first of all, you cannot suspend your benefit before full retirement age. And if, for example, if had Jan filed for her retirement benefit, maybe she was already collecting her retirement benefit, and had Paul tried to get a spousal benefit, let's say at 63, he would have been forced to take his retirement benefit at that point. It's only when you reach full retirement age that you can take your retirement benefit, your spousal benefit by itself.
I see.
So when you're forced to take two benefits at once, you're screwed, because they only give you the larger of the two. So the whole name of the game here is to time your benefit receipt. Take one benefit first and let the other one grow. But you have to be careful about their gotcha rules.
That sort of begs the question. Wouldn't it make dollar sense if they were to divorce? Then they both get their full benefit.
Here's the thing. One of the two can get a full or free spousal benefit if they play their cards right. But if they're divorced, both divorcees, divorced spouses, both of them can get a full divorcee spousal benefit if they've been married for 10 or more years. So, for example, Paul and his wife, Jan, could have gotten divorced at 64. You need to be divorced for 2 years to start collecting divorcee spousal benefits. But they could have been divorced for 2 years. And then at 66, they could have both have filed for a full spousal benefit, just for a spousal benefit, and then waited till 70 to collect the retirement benefit. So rather than getting $50,000 more, had they gotten divorced and then lived in sin and then maybe remarried at 70, they could have picked up $100,000 more. And that's a lot of money for a lot of middle-class people.
But let me ask you this. What is to stop a married couple, both high earners, both paid Social Security all their years and all their working years, and 2 years before they hit 70 years of age, they file and suspend? Then they divorce. So why can't each of them get the maximum benefit?
Well, if they both, let's take the case where they both earn the same amount, okay? So they both have the same age 70 retirement benefit, and they got divorced, whether or not, let's say they did get divorced. So they could both file for a spousal benefit. But if they try and take two things at once, their retirement benefit and their spousal benefit, let's say from 70 on, and after age 70, your retirement benefit doesn't get any bigger if you wait to collect it, so you have to kind of take it. It makes no sense not to. So then you're in a situation where you get the larger of the two benefits. Almost always for, you know, decent earners, your retirement benefit's going to exceed your spousal benefit or your divorcee spousal benefit. So you actually won't get any spousal benefit. It'll be wiped out by the retirement benefit. So the game to be played here is to take your spousal benefit first between full retirement age, at full retirement age, and then wait till 70 to take your own retirement benefit. That, of course, you know, there's lots of special cases. For example, if you have a I can give you an example of a actual household where the husband is about 61, the wife is 45, they have a disabled child. She's earned a lot of money, but she stopped working to take care of the child. The husband is retiring. Now, should he take his benefit at 62 or wait till 70 or wait till 66 for retirement age? Well, it turns out we have this, I have a company on the side, and we have a program called Maximize My Social Security at MaximizeMySocialSecurity.com, which we discuss a little bit in the book. And if you run that case through our software, it tells the husband to take his retirement benefit immediately. Now, that seems strange, because he's going to get a reduced retirement benefit,
But because he does that, he can activate a child benefit for the child and also a child in care spouse benefit for the wife. The two together can collect anywhere between 50 to 85% of his full retirement benefit. Not his reduced benefit, but of his full retirement benefit.
Whoa.
So then he can wait till 66, till full retirement age, and at 66 he can suspend his benefit. It won't affect their benefits. They can still collect on his record, and he can start up again at 70. So he takes a hit under the strategy, which we call start, stop, start. He starts his benefit. He suspends it at 66. That means stopping it, and then restarting it at 70. Under that strategy, he ends up with lower lifetime benefits on it for himself, but higher lifetime benefits for the family, and that's the optimal strategy in their case. So, and that particular case involves them taking 10 different benefits through time, because ultimately the child starts collecting on the mom's record, and then the husband dies, and he starts collecting a child survivor benefit on the dad's record, and then the mom dies, and the kid starts collecting on the mom's record, and...
Now, do you think that reforming Social Security is in the future? Do books like yours and discussions like this move the needle towards working on preparing the inequities in the system?
Well, I think Social Security is definitely broke, in my opinion. We have a big debate in the last chapter. My co-authors kind of disagree with me, but I think they're not economists, and I think they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I love them dearly, but the reality is that if you look at the trustees report, Social Security trustees, they'll tell you in table 6F1, if you look at the fine print, that the system is 33% underfinanced compared to the Detroit pensions, which were 20% underfinanced before Detroit went bankrupt because it couldn't afford that. So Social Security needs more revenue through time to pay for all the promised benefits. It needs 33% more revenue. That's what it means to be 33% underfinanced. But there's a vast army of older people associated together through the American Association of Retired People, people called the AARP.
Right.
They're the strongest lobby group in Washington. They've got 50 million members. It's very hard, I think, for Congress to change any benefit provisions for anybody who's now retired, anybody who's close to retired, probably anybody 55 or older is not going to ever see any change in the benefit formulas. What we could possibly envision is a phase-in of a new system for younger people, and I have a proposal to do that at the purpleplans.org, thepurpleplans.org, thought through how to fix Social Security for younger people because it desperately needs to be fixed.
I have a couple more questions before our time is up. These are about taxes and tax consequences. So when you get Social Security, is it income taxed? And what if you wanted to work? How much money can you earn working without having to pay more and more income tax?
You can see up to 85% of your Social Security benefits subject to taxation. Mm-hmm. And one way to avoid that is to try and take some of your retirement account money out early, like your 401k money or your IRA money. Now, if you're in a Roth, that's not going to affect the taxation of your Social Security benefits. So Roth conversions may make sense. Another concern about working that you raised the idea of working and how that affects your Social Security benefits. Well, Social Security has something called the earnings test. So suppose you file for retirement benefits, this earnings test applies up through the point that you reach full retirement age. So maybe you're 64, you decide to retire or work part-time, and now you're earning more than about $15,000. Well, you're going to lose a dollar of benefits for every $2 that you earn. But I wouldn't be too concerned about that because at full retirement age, Social Security has something called the adjustment of the reduction factor, and they bump up your retirement benefits to compensate you for having lost money through the earnings test. So this earnings test is really a way to con the elderly out of working because you have this kind of make-believe tax. People aren't told about the fact that it's offset by higher benefits in the future. And so everybody thinks that if they work, they're going to be hit by this earnings test. They'll lose their Social Security benefits, which they will temporarily, but then they'll get higher benefits later. But it leads a lot of people to stop working or to work just below $15,000 in terms of what they earn. So We discuss all this in the book, At What's Yours, The Secrets to Maxing Out Your Social Security Benefits. So I recommend it. I would not ask Social Security anything about your Social Security benefits. I would tell them what to do. They can't be trusted. They've been making the most basic mistakes time and again in the different offices around the country. And just the idea of taking your benefits early. Let's say you took them at 63, and now maybe you're single, never married. You want to start them at a higher level at 7. You want to suspend them. You're now full retirement age. People around the country in Social Security offices have been telling folks that they can't suspend their benefits, which is absolutely 100% wrong. I just interacted with an office in Tacoma, Washington. A lady was told 5 times on the phone the wrong thing, and then 2 times in the office the wrong thing. And then I called the head of the office and explained to him what the law was, and he fixed it. And he had a meeting with his staff. They didn't have no idea what they're doing. The last people you want to ask about Social Security is Social Security.
That's kind of like the IRS. Everybody warns against asking them questions. The book is titled Get What's Yours, Secrets to Maximizing Your Social Security Benefits. We've been speaking with the author, Boston University economics professor, Lawrence Kotlikoff.
Did you get your dose of Steve today? Steve Peasley's market commentary can't always put things right in the market, but it can put things into perspective. They're for you every morning on InvestTalk.com.
Cliff in Pacific Beach. How you doing, Cliff?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Most of us are contributing into some sort of retirement account, right?
Yes.
I happen to contribute into the TSP, the U.S. government.
Got it.
I just bumped mine $100 contribution a pay period.
Okay.
My check went down $41.
Your paycheck went, then they matched money for you?
No, negative. It took that much off my taxes.
And
I'm not a wealthy man. And my daughter happens to work for the government, and so does my son-in-law. So I happen to mention my daughter. She says, well, Daddy, I have the 50-cent rule. Every time you take a dollar out for put it in the TSP, your check only goes down 50 cents. Well, it seems to me that mitigates a lot of the risk.
It does mitigate a lot of risk. And when the way you're doing it, Cliff, with every paycheck, that's called dollar cost averaging.
Absolutely.
As the prices come down, depending on how many years left you have, how old are you?
Older than you, son.
Uh-oh. If you have 5 years, 3 to 5 to 7 years left, you kind of want the market to be a little bit under pressure downward because you're buying more and more shares. Then, just a year or two before you retire, you want it to shoot up.
Well, I'm on the old system, so I don't particularly care.
Yeah, you're on the pension system?
Yeah, but my daughter, she's in the other...
The 401k type system?
Right.
And or the 403b or whatever they call it these days.
Yeah, and there's great choices to choose from. But it makes a lot of difference. Makes a very little money, and at 50 cents on the dollar, it sure helps out.
You certainly want to do that. Yep. Cliff, appreciate the call. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our live phone line is open for another 10 minutes or so before the end of the show. If you have a question you want answered, you can do it right now. We're open for you. 888-99-CHART. Any financial question you might have, be happy to talk about it. 888-99-CHART. That's how you reach us here on Invest Talk.
Part of the Invest Talk experience is visiting our website, investtalk.com. And one of the reasons for a visit is Steve's market commentary. Just go to investtalk.com and scroll down to his market commentary. Our podcast distribution is made possible every day by KPP Financial. Steve Peasley, President. What's the most important reason to go with a registered investment advisor? Their number one fiduciary responsibility is protecting your assets, watching the markets closely, and having a ready plan
to respond to changing market and economic conditions. KPP Financial offers a whole range of financial services for their clients, and now KPP Financial has a licensed real estate agent on staff to help you make the best possible choices when it comes to decisions about your home. To learn more about their investment programs, visit investtalk.com and click on the Investments tab.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
888-99-CHART, let's talk to Gabe in San Jose. How you doing, Gabe?
Hey, doing good. Good show.
Thank you.
My question, Fed didn't raise the interest rate today, but in the event that they do in the next couple of months,
yes.
What is that one stock or that industry which is set to or poised to pop up the most? And I'll take your answer offline.
Okay. If the Federal Reserve does raise interest rates, what industry or sector will it help the most? Well, I think what you're going to see is you almost have to inverse that question. What will it hurt the most? And, of course, that will be those companies who have debt. Debt that they have to refinance things. So what industry or sector will it help the most? Probably those companies or sectors that don't rely on debt at all. And I would kind of lean on tech. I think the tech sector, they don't need higher or lower interest rates. It's not something that they're worried about, that concerns them. So I don't know if there's any one individual sector that will work better than the other than those sectors requiring debt to survive. Now, the exception would be banks, by the way, which do need debt to survive. But that would be the exception because they can borrow money, even if it's a little more expensive. They can lend it out a little more expensive. So I do think the ones with the industry with the least amount of exposure to debt is probably the best. And that would be, you know, high-tech companies. I think they would probably do the best. Thanks, Gabe. I appreciate the call. Michael, Half Moon Bay. How you doing, Michael?
Okay, I don't know a whole lot about this subject. So okay. I think it's a pretty good question, though. I worked for a company. I invested in my stock. I bought it outright when I left the company. It's still a privately held company. It has not gone public. But it was just recently purchased by a, I guess the term is a blank check company that's already public.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what that means for me and my stock. I got a letter saying that they were going to purchase my stock back from me. But I was kind of holding out till it goes to common stock, but I'm not sure if I'm capable. It doesn't sound like they're going to let me do that.
No, since it's a private company, it's not a public company, you don't have much say.
Okay.
They're going to buy all the stock. Question in your mind is, what are you going to buy it for? How much?
Well, they made an offer to me, but I'm like, I don't know that if I do I have an opportunity to go back and say, no, I want to sell you it for this much and see what they say.
If your stock has a voting power, do you know if it does?
I don't think I have enough for a voting power, no.
Yeah, see, most of the voting power is probably held by the insiders, the people who...
Exactly.
Okay, and those guys are going to make the decision. You are not.
You're
going to have to follow on their coattails. Unfortunately, the option that would be left to you is filing suit as a minority shareholder.
Right.
You feel like you're getting a shaft, and the majority shareholders are getting the benefits, and you're not.
Right.
That does happen, but it's extremely expensive, and you don't want to go that route.
It's a nice little chunk, and I'm happy, but I had absolutely different plans for that money.
And so they messed it up for you.
Well, I mean, at least something happened with it. It's been a while, you know what I mean?
So yes.
I feel good about that. Now, what would you think about taking some of that money and buying it into the company that just bought?
If you feel that the fundamentals of the company, of the shares that you own, if you feel that's really going to benefit this new company and it's really going to accelerate this new public company's earnings, then yeah, that's a good way to go. If it's so small, the company that stock that you own, if it's like 5% or 10% of the company that's buying it, then it will make no difference. You have to look at the company that's buying it to make sure that they're solid.
Right, right.
So take a look at the relative size and what it really is going to do to their earnings.
Okay.
Well, good luck with it, Michael.
Well, thank you very much. You were very helpful. I appreciate the time.
Thank you for calling. I had an email from someone who wanted me to talk about Equity Key. They just saw an advertisement online for a product that claims you can access your home's cash appreciated value without making monthly payments. What it is it's not a reverse mortgage. It's no loan at all. What this Equity Key is doing is they're buying your future appreciation. Okay, so they're going to give you money, and they'll give you anywhere from 6.9% to 17.25% of the current value of your house, but you have to give them the appreciation of your house, 30 to 75% of the appreciation, depending on how much money they loan you. So that's, is there a downside to it? Yes. I read all the highlights, and of course, you know, the details, the fine print are going to be key when you do something like this. So it's not a loan, but it is an attachment. They put a lien on your property. So know that. Before we close the hour, many investors today are chasing yield, but in a rising rate environment, high yielding stocks tend to suffer. But some dividend payers are doing well. We have 10 names that have a long track record of dividend growth. This list is available for all InvestTalk insiders. Join up free on InvestTalk.com. I'm Portfolio Manager Steve Peasley. On behalf of Justin Klein, everyone at KPP Financial, thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.